This is a holiday weekend for America. Decoration Day, Memorial Day, a time set apart to honor those who serve their country in the highest measure. A time, too, for taking stock. A time to measure men and events in retrospect. Memorial Day weekend has often brought with it events which have changed the course of nations, the world. For example, in 1938, the tension between Hitler's Germany and a free Czechoslovakia was reaching a climax. The seeds of Munich were being sown. And in this country, another generation of naval officers was leaving Annapolis. Their commander-in-chief had come to speak at the graduation ceremonies.
With the president this morning, his son James, his military aide, Colonel Watson, and his naval aide, Captain Woodson.
This was 1938, 12 years ago. Franklin Roosevelt, who loved the sea, felt very much at home with these new sailors.
The only time that I completely disgraced myself at graduation exercises was, I think, during the World War. Because of the strenuous work in the Navy Department, I was a bit in arrears in sleep. There I was, sitting on the right of the superintendent of the Naval Academy, and the speaker of the occasion began his address. My eyes slowly but firmly closed. Could anything be more unmilitary, more humiliating, and at the same time, more completely satisfactory?
Let's continue this check of the record of Memorial Day history. Move forward a year. Recall this very weekend in 1939. Now the world is close to war. The tensions have heightened. And in Washington, the American Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, reminded the nation that brute force was at large and uncontrolled.
These are perilous times in the lives of individuals and of nations. Violence and threat of violence haunt the world. Again, as unfortunately on so many occasions in the past, one of the most exalted aims of civilization and progress, namely, the banishment of brute force as the arbiter of relations among nations, is being subjected to a strident and powerful challenge.
The strident and powerful challenge of Nazi Germany had at least in part inspired a visit to North America by the royal family of Great Britain. King George VI and his queen had come to the New World to strengthen the ties with the USA and Canada. On this day, 11 years ago, in a western Canadian city, the King of England won for himself three cheers and a tiger.
Someday, the peoples of the world will come to realize that prosperity lies in cooperation and not in conflict.
So we all rise and get three cheers for their majesties.
Hip, hip, hip. Hooray! Hip, hip, hip. Hooray! Hip, hip, hip. Hooray! Hooray!
His Majesty's words were in vain. In just over 3 months, his nation was at war. Now, Memorial Day 1940. We're in Arlington National Cemetery. The speaker is Paul V. McNutt, Federal Security Administrator. He chooses his words carefully as he speaks to a nation which wishes to avoid war, but upon whom world events weigh heavily.
If America can avoid a war by any action, less than actual participation in hostilities, it is the part of wisdom to take such action. If by extending credits to the democracies, fighting with their backs to the sea, defeat for their cause may be averted, the future welfare and safety of this country would justify such a course.
Yes, 10 years ago. The national conventions were just a few weeks away, and in both the Republican and Democratic parties, there was anxiety about the political future. Out of nowhere, a dark horse had claimed the attention of the GOP. A businessman lawyer named Wendell Willkie was speech-making at every opportunity, and a lot of Republicans were very impressed. 10 years ago today, he was speaking in St. Louis.
Winston Churchill, in whose hands rests the fate of England, and for that matter, perhaps the fate of all Europe, was installed as Prime Minister only a few months ago. His first speech in Parliament sounded a strange note. Churchill made none of the usual promises. He did not offer the people higher incomes. He did not offer them bread and circuses, as the old Roman emperors used to do. "I have nothing to offer you," he said, "except blood, tears, toil, and sweat."
And the man Mr. Willkie would have to beat was being very quiet on the subject of his availability for a third term. When he gave his fireside chat on this 1940 Memorial Day weekend, he appealed for prayers for peace.
"Day and night, I pray for the restoration of peace in this mad world of ours. It is not necessary that I, the President, ask the American people to pray in behalf of such a cause, for I know you are praying with me. I am certain that out of the hearts of every man, woman, and child in this land, in every waking minute, a supplication goes up to Almighty God, that all of us beg that suffering and starving, that death and destruction may end, and that peace may return to the world."
It was a moment for prayer. In Europe, the Belgian army had collapsed. The evacuation of Dunkirk began on this day 10 years ago. The holiday weekend in America brought no holiday from war in Europe. We move ahead now. 9 years ago, this is 1941. For hard-pressed Britain, the weekend brought heartening news, a victory at sea, which even Berlin was forced to admit to the world.
35,000-ton German battleship Bismarck is on the bottom of the North Atlantic. This was the news given to the German people this afternoon, along with a dramatic last message from Admiral Lutyens, who was in personal command of the ship. The message, of brief sailor-like dispatch, was sent to the supreme command of the German Navy. It said, "Ship unable to maneuver, we shall fight to our last shell." The short radio message ended with the words, "Long live the Führer."
The pride of the German Navy was at the bottom of the sea. And in London, a 24-year-old RAF captain who had spotted the battleship told his story for NBC.
"It was a hazy morning with poor visibility, and suddenly, at 10:30, we saw a dark shape ahead in the mist. We were flying low at the time. The second pilot and I were sitting side by side, and we both saw the ship at the same time. At first, we could hardly believe our eyes. I believe we both shouted, 'There she is,' or something of the sort. There was a 40-knot wind blowing and a terrific sea, and she was digging her nose right in, throwing it white over her bows. And then we were surrounded by dark, brownish-black smoke as she pooped off at us with everything she'd got."
And in Washington, President Roosevelt proclaimed an unlimited national emergency. It was fast becoming a world war on this weekend in 1941.
"The pressing problems that confront us are military and naval problems. We cannot afford to approach them from the point of view of wishful thinkers or sentimentalists. What we face is cold, hard fact. The first and fundamental fact is that what started as a European war has developed, as the Nazis always intended it should develop, into a war for world domination."
That was 1941. A year later, in 1942, the United States observed its first wartime Memorial Day weekend. Events had committed us irrevocably to the struggle 8 years ago. The battle for Libya was underway, the Germans were in Kharkov, and the Japanese bombed Dutch Harbor in Alaska. We were so preoccupied with the struggle that, as Earl Godwin pointed out, there was scarcely time to declare war against minor enemies.
We're on the verge of three more wars, and nobody's excited. While the business of 3 gallons of gas as a ration for one and all creates more furor than anyone has seen since Aunt Lizzie caught her pigtails in the ringer. Yes, the president says we ought to be at war with Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria just to balance things up because they declared a war on us. And you know the House will probably, for itself, declare those wars tomorrow or next day if we get around to it. But the Senate, mind you, is on a 3 days leave.
Then as now. Well, let's conclude this backward look at other Memorial Days with a reminder that our losses have not always been casualties of war. On May 29, 1942, America lost its greatest actor, John Barrymore. In his prime, he'd brought to the stage a portrayal of Hamlet to be cherished as long as men remember. There were moments like this as John Barrymore read the famous speech to the players and savored every word.
Speak the speech, I pray you. Trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of your players do, I'd as lief have the town crier speak my lines. And do not saw the air to with your hand thus, but use all gently, for in the very torrent, tempest, and I may say whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it smoothness.
I warrant, Your Honor.
Be not too tame, neither, but let your own discretion be your tutor. Suit the action to the word to the action, that with a special observance, that you o'erstep not the modesty of nature. For anything that's overdone is from the purpose of playing, whose end, both at the first and now, was and is to hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature, to show virtue her own feature, scorn her own image, and the very age and body of the time, its form and pressure.
Aye, my lord.
God be with you.
Now, John Barrymore, in the final scene of Shakespeare's masterpiece, the king is dead, the queen is dead, and a dying Hamlet speaks to his friend Horatio.
Oh, good Horatio, what a wounded name, thing standing thus unknown, shall live behind me. If thou didst ever hold me in thy heart, absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world, draw thy breath in pain to tell my story. The rest is silence.
Now cracks a noble heart. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
5 years of history from 1938 through 1942. These were other Memorial Day weekends. Now time calls a halt to our recollections, and voices and events must hurry to the present. We listen then to 200 men and women singing one of America's great anthems, and to words about democracy from one who's worked for it around the world, the United Nations' Dr. Ralph Bunche. This is 1950.
We cannot afford to forget that in this age, a good part of the world looks to us for a convincing demonstration of American democracy as an incomparable way of life. It is not enough for us to preach democracy and to exalt its ideals. We must honor democracy in the practice. In short, it should mean a society in which human values have the highest priority and in which free men can live and work in security and look to the future with reasonable confidence. But obviously, it should also mean a society in which the individual citizen exercises his rights and his privileges with a deep sense of responsibility and recognizes fully his obligations to the nation and to his fellow citizens.
We have news to bring, so I feel love.
This has been Voices and Events, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. History in the making, recorded by the NBC News and Special Events Department. James Fleming was the editor and narrator. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen next week at this same hour for Voices and Events. An international audience listens each week to this Voices and Events broadcast of the NBC News and Special Events Department. Portions of this program are shortwaved around the world through the facilities of the State Department's Voice of America.